Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Practical Perspectives, as today our faculty review actual cases of patients with biliary tract cancers from docs in practice. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Haley Ellis from the MGH, Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts, Massachusetts General Hospital, and Dr. Jim Harding from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Today, we're here to talk about biliary tract cancer, and as always, we will be discussing the use of agents and regimens that are outside the FDA indications, so check out prescribing information for specific products for more. As we've been doing a lot since the pandemic, we're going to be presenting cases from community-based general medical oncologists. I think we presented almost 5,000 cases this way. These are docs, so I sit down with them for hour and a half. They present cases, everything from CLL to myeloma, bladder cancer, breast cancer. Well, today it's going to be biliary tract cancer, so we'll see what people are thinking and seeing in the community. And really, we're going to make rounds today and intersperse some discussion of data sets. This is where we're heading and some of the topics we'll be discussing. And before we kind of get started on specific practical issues, I just wanted to take a step back. I sort of called this, Haley, this introduction, you know, we've been hearing this, I'd like to claim I'm one of the first people to come up with this saying, but a lot of people did, which is biliary tract cancer the new non-small cell lung cancer? We've been saying that for a while, but what I want to ask you all is why. I was kind of thinking about this, Haley, which is that, you know, non-small cell lung cancer, we have the people with the targetable mutations tend to be younger. They tend to be non-smokers, so that it kind of seems like a different type of cancer. But now we come over here, and maybe even more common, I mean, like maybe a third of patients overall, and in some subsets even more, with targetable mutations. And I, as we were preparing for this, I was just trying to think, well, like, why? Like, I have at least a little bit of an idea when it comes to lung cancer. It kind of ties into your vision of, like, how people actually get this cancer, Haley. Any thoughts about why we see so many targetable mutations in this cancer?
You know, I totally agree with the statement that BTC is the new small cell lung cancer, and I really think it's a model for precision oncology in GI cancers and has really been leading the way in targeted therapies. You know, in terms of the patient profile that we see that tend to have targetable alterations, certainly we see this very highly enriched with oncogenic drivers in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. Alterations like FGFR2 fusions, we do see more commonly in young patients, particularly women. And we know that patients with FGFR2 fusions, for example, have better outcomes. So that's one example of sort of a patient profile.
Jim, any thoughts on this? And any thoughts about the etiology of this disease? I wonder about gallstones, in terms of gallbladder cancer. Any new theories about this?
Well, I mean, I think it's clear that many of the etiologic factors are driven by some form of inflammation. So as you stated, stones, cholelithiasis, this is clearly a risk factor. But anything that could inflame the biliary tree or damage the liver might be a risk factor. Infections such as hepatitis, even parasites like liver fluke, these have been associated with it. Environmental hazards, alcohol, there are many. And I think that biologically, they probably each type of inflammation may lead to damage in a different way. But ultimately, for biliary tract cancers, there's a plethora of actionable alterations that are found. And I agree with Dr. Ellis. You know, it's about 40% of biliary tract cancers that are inside the liver, 20 that are outside the liver, and 30 that are gallbladder. And I think we're going to be adding to that with the advent of RAS-targeted therapeutics and other novel gene mutations and precision strategies.
So, Haley, here's one slide looking at the incidence of targetable mutations based on geography, so to speak, or anatomy, I guess I should say. Can you talk a little bit about that? And also, how do you think through assays that you want to do in patients with biliary cancer, whether it's NGS or liquid or IHC? And do you get that? Do you work patients up as soon as they're diagnosed, or only if they have metastatic disease? So you can talk a little bit of an overview of what types of mutations we see and how you think through doing assays, Haley.
Absolutely. So certainly, though we do classify biliary tract cancers based on where they are found within the biliary tree, genomically, intra versus extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma and gallbladder cancer are genomically very different. So alterations like FGFR2 fusions and IDH1 mutations are almost exclusively found in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, whereas alterations like HER2 amplification or overexpression, KRAS mutations are more commonly seen in extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma and gallbladder cancer. In terms of, you know, the importance and the timing of next generation sequencing, this has just been absolutely transformative for biliary tract cancers. Certainly for patients that do not have targetable alterations, which can be as many as, you know, 60%+ of patients, you know, our second line standard of care therapies have response rates on the order of 5%, whereas many of these targeted therapies can have response rates up to 50% even, so, and have, you know, much improved survival. So finding these patients is so critical. I typically am testing patients at time of diagnosis with very comprehensive profiling with DNA and RNA-based testing, which is so important to look for some of these rare targetable fusions, as well as HER2 immunohistochemistry. You know, we have an increasing number of available targeted therapies for HER2, and we know that if we're actually just looking at next-gen sequencing, where we're looking at copy number changes, we can miss about 15% of people who have HER2-positive disease if we don't include IHC. So I think it's important to test early and test comprehensively.
So again, thinking about lung cancer, one of the issues here is, you know, there's about 1/10 the amount of biliary cancer as there is lung cancer. There are a lot less patients to do research on, not to mention that the docs in practice are going to see it 1/10 as frequently, so it's even more of a challenge, and you'll hear some of them verbalize about that. Jim, anything you want to add to that in terms of assays? And what about the issue of repeat assays, looking for the development of new mutations? We were talking about, we're about to do a program on SERDs and breast cancer. There, you don't see it at initial diagnosis and metastasis only until later. How about in biliary?
Yeah, great. So I echo the earlier, the better, the most comprehensive, the better. I think it's important we remember that, you know, these tumors are sometimes quite necrotic or the sampling is quite small. So I expect a 10% failure rate, and that's been reported in the literature. So I think at the initial diagnosis, it's important to get these comprehensive panels. And if the test fails or is it not possible, I do get a new biopsy to determine the genomic driver. With regard to sequential biopsying, I think that's quite interesting scientifically. There are some data to support, you know, particularly with FGFR, that there are select mutations that may develop and that you might be able to target them with a next generation FGFR inhibitor or even those that are available. I don't think that's fully ready for prime time, but I do think in the research context, we are doing serial biopsies and even less invasively liquid biopsy.
So let's go make some rounds now. We'll see some actual patients. And I want to say before we even get started how grateful we are to these physicians who over the last few years have been presenting these cases, putting their therapy out there for everybody to see, and, you know, candidly asking, you know, questions about taking care of these patients. When the initial data came out in the first line setting with IOs combined with chemotherapy, we were focused on that all the time when we were talking about biliary. I think people are kind of settling into that pretty well, although we'll see what happens in the future. And today we're going to focus a lot more on targeted therapy for a lot of the reasons we just talked about. But I want to begin with an upfront case. This is a patient of Dr. Brenner, who, like most patients who present with metastatic disease, got treated with GemCis and an IO, in this case, durvalumab.
This is a 75-year-old patient who had metastatic cholangiocarcinoma from an intrahepatic cholangio, who received standard therapy with gemcitabine and cisplatin together with durvalumab, completed 8 cycles, but unfortunately progressed shortly after completing a chemotherapy. This is a picture of an intrahepatic tumor, and sitting just above that, some of the disease on the surface of her liver. My question for the investigators are there subtypes such as gallbladder cancer versus intrahepatic versus extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma who may respond differently to these agents, particularly checkpoint inhibitors? Is there any differential effect based on PD-L1 and tumor mutation burden? And what are the management options for patients with progressive disease who have no targetable mutations?
So, Jim, we'll start out with you. Any thoughts about PD-1 levels, TMB, location of the tumor, anything else in terms of predictors of a benefit?
Well, obviously, biliary tract cancer, multiple anatomic sites, they're not clinically the same. Though in the pivotal studies, particularly TOPAZ-1, you know, in long-term follow-up data, there didn't appear to be at least the benefit that was observed was seen in all specific subtypes. That was published and updated in the Journal of Hepatology not long ago. And from my perspective, I haven't seen that anatomic site is clearly a major determinant of response to immunotherapy. From a genomic standpoint or from a molecular perspective, the one subsite which I suspect would respond much better, of course, are those that are MSI high and have mismatch repair deficiency, which is uncommon. That's a few percent of biliary tract cancers. For these other markers, such as TMB, PD-1, PD-L1, PD-L1 was looked at in the TOPAZ-1 study, and again, in the subset analysis, there seemed to be a benefit in each subtype. I think, obviously, larger studies might be required to really tease that out, but I don't discriminate based on this. Likewise, the emerging data from the genomic composite of this didn't show a clear winner in that regard. So at the present time, I would approach, you know, a fit patient that doesn't have a necessary contraindication, I would give them gemcitabine cisplatin and immunotherapy as was done in this case. And there wasn't sort of an upfront selection based on at least the data presented here for the patient, in my opinion.
And then, Haley, in terms of choice of IO, is it a coin flip from your point of view, at least from a medical point of view? Also, and we see here are the results from the TOPAZ study. I mean, modest benefit, as well as the KEYNOTE study. What about the tail of the curve? I mean, to look at this, it doesn't look like it's particularly, and do you see people with long-term benefits from IOs and biliary tract cancer? And also, what about Dr. Brenner's question about second line and people without targetable mutations, Haley?
So I think in the first line setting, in terms of immunotherapy choice, certainly I think the TOPAZ-1 and KEYNOTE-966 data showed pretty similar outcomes, of course not accounting for cross-trial comparisons. This tail of the curve that we see so commonly in immunotherapy trials, I think, is critical. And I think we all do see that there are patients who are benefiting long-term from the addition of immunotherapy to chemotherapy. Certainly, with the 3-year overall survival data from TOPAZ-1 showing a doubling of 3-year overall survival, that's really encouraging. And I think the million-dollar question is, who are those patients who are benefiting? And I think a lot of work is being done to try and find, you know, the genomic subsets or immune subsets that are benefiting most. In the second line setting, certainly I do think it would be important if comprehensive NGS hasn't been done to ensure that that's done. For patients without biomarkers, we do have data for 5-FU-based regimens like FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, NALIRI 5-FU. Response rates are on the order of about 5 to 10% with median overall survival of about less than 6 months. So responses are quite limited. You know, there was encouraging data more recently from drugs like CTX-009, which was a phase 2-3 study in combination with paclitaxel that showed a response rate of 17%. So it will be exciting to hopefully have more therapies to offer patients who have do not have targetable biomarkers at this point.
So I was thinking about the fact that, right at this point, either one of these IOs look the same, but we did a program last week on the small cell, and there they were in the same situation. They had two IOs that seemed to be equal, atezolizumab and durvalumab. And then at the ASCO meeting, as you can see, a new study came out, the Inforte study, where they added lurbinectin, a cytotoxic, to, in this case, it was atezolizumab, and pretty significant bump. But it's interesting that maybe now we're going to see more people using atezolizumab, because even though it doesn't seem to be better, this is the study that they did of the, so maybe that'll happen. You know, same thing with some of these other trials we're looking at with biliary in the first line, when they get paired with chemo IO, whatever IO they get paired with. And here's the data from that study, is likely what'll be carried into practice. And just a couple of trials. Also, Jim, I'm curious what your thoughts are. Again, thinking back to first line therapy, I like the name of this trial, the Neo Disco study. I think this is out of Amsterdam. But neoadjuvant therapy. Jim, any thoughts about this study and others looking at neoadjuvant? Do you think we're going to end up there?
Yeah. I can dance to it. You know, I think that it's. I do think. Although the benefit is modest, at least in the metastatic setting, I think it's proven that an anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 therapy extends life, and it's modest. There is a hypothesis that's being borne out across many solid tumors that delivering an immunotherapy or combinatorial therapy with immunotherapy at earlier stage of disease may also add a benefit. And we've seen that recently at ASCO for a number of solid tumors, particularly gastric. And so I do think a study looking at a perioperative therapy is quite important. And so it would be interesting to see the readout here. Obviously, I mean, I don't feel this full design, but there is, you know, it would be interesting to see how these patients are treated in follow-up and what therapies they get. But I think we'll see more perioperative approaches for sure. And it's an important space in biliary tract cancer that is currently investigational.
And again, speaking of the same space, we have this really wild adjuvant trial looking at rivlugostimib, a bispecific that targets, I think, PD-1 and TIGIT being added to chemotherapy. So really exciting. All right, let's move on to another upfront case that's going to start to lead us where we're going to spend most of our time. But a few more issues about upfront therapy. This is a patient, a 79-year-old man, a patient of Dr. Morgenstein. And like many patients who are contemplating with their physicians the use of IO, this man had a history of prior autoimmune disease, Crohn's disease, which at the time he was diagnosed with biliary was, quote, well controlled. But as Dr. Morgenstein will mention, he was also on medication for Crohn's disease. Here's what happened.
A 79-year-old gentleman presented with metastatic biliary cancer. He had a history of Crohn's disease. And this was a little more difficult because it was somewhat more active Crohn's disease, although not active when I met him. He was on medication for it. So after very careful discussion with his gastroenterologist and with the patient, we treated him with chemo and IO. And unfortunately, he had exacerbation of his Crohn's, which was kind of bad. So we had to stop not only the IO, but we stopped his chemo for a long time. He actually wound up in the hospital. He progressed, and on his initial immunohistochemistry, he was HER2/2+ positive. So we were able to get him TDXD. This was a little bit more difficult to get. He received two doses, but unfortunately had no improvement and passed, you know, fairly quickly afterwards on hospice. So on him, what is the role of TDXD in HER2/2+ hepatobiliary cancer? And same thing for zanidatamab. Is there any data in the HER2/2+ settings? And even more, is there any role for HER2-low like we're doing in breast cancer? Unaware of that, but is it worth a shot in people with limited, if not very limited, treatment options? And then when we try to counsel patients, we're all very excited about IO across tumor types. But in hepatobiliary cancer, what is the absolute benefit that we may be giving a patient with immunotherapies in these settings?
So we'll get into the HER2 question in a second. And Haley, actually, I pulled a few of the slides you used at one of our symposia at ASCO because they were so great and well thought out. But Jim, just to start out too with this issue of IO and people with autoimmune disease, of course, this man unfortunately really had a major issue. I think the last question he asked was like, how much benefit are we really seeing to justify taking a risk, which he did in this patient, which ended up not being a great one. How do you think through that issue in general, Jim, about how much autoimmune disease will get you to hold off?
I think that, you know, initially when immunotherapy came out, you know, 10 plus years ago, it was probably a strong contraindication, you know, to hold these drugs in patients with autoimmune conditions. And as time has evolved, I think we're starting to realize that there are certain autoimmunities which are burnt out and or fully treated, where there is the potential to give an anti-PD-1 or a PD-L1 antibody with still observed benefit, with either no or potentially higher rate of toxicity than what was seen in trials in patients without autoimmunity. So it can be done, but like in this case, it's really a shared decision-making model and requires like a multi-D approach to have the right team on board. In my point of view, I think there are certain things that are still strongly contraindicated, like post-liver transplant, although that's being looked at investigationally. The data has suggested a high risk of sort of graft rejection. But in other diseases, I think there's a more permissive nature. And so I don't think, you know, I think the approach was thoughtful and reasonable, but you have to have a team on board and know that the rate of immune-related events could be higher in these patients. As to the benefit, you saw the Kaplan-Meier yourself. I mean, there is an absolute improvement in median of about 2 months, but the key of the tail of the curve is that there is a doubling in survival. And so I think you have to adjudicate that with patients. I'm pretty cautious about giving it with active autoimmunity. I like to see it well controlled. And in some instances, it's not the right thing to do.
So again, Haley, these are such a great series of slides that you went in. I think better than anything I've seen outside of breast cancer, trying to attack this issue of assays for HER2 and how to interpret them. Beginning with this one, looking at various tumors and the incidence of expression, and it seems like biliary is almost similar to breast cancer, if not more. But any thoughts about in general where we see overexpression of HER2 in different tumor types, Haley?
Certainly, we see higher levels of HER2 overexpression or amplification in gallbladder cancer most frequently. In the U.S., we can see it anywhere from about 10 to 20%, though it can be as high as 40% in East Asia and places like Korea. Extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma would be a little bit less frequent, and in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, we would see sort of single-digit percentages.
And then in terms of, and of course, there are multiple modalities to attack or use HER2 as a potential target. We're going to talk about a couple of these. But this was an extremely helpful slide, Haley. I get so many questions about how to interpret NGS when it says, quote, HER2 positive, which is really, I think, looking at DNA, and you're talking about over expression or similar to what you see with in situ hybridization. But you can kind of explain a little bit. And also, do you pick up positive HER2 on immunohistochemistry that you could miss on NGS?
Great question. So I do think it's really important, particularly in biliary tract cancer, to be looking at both NGS and immunohistochemistry with reflex in situ hybridization testing, if that's indicated. Right now, for immunohistochemistry testing, we're using the gastric scoring criteria, given that the pattern of expression is very different from breast cancer. So we're using the gastric cancer model. And essentially, if patients are 3+ or 2+, and in situ hybridization positive, that would be considered HER2 positive. HER2 amplification is a little bit more nuanced in terms of the exact copy number, and what we're determining is sort of HER2 amplified. But I do think, you know, and they've shown a nice study that was presented on a poster at ASCO GI this year, showing that, you know, exactly this slide, in patients that are only having NGS testing, who have non-amplification by NGS, you can miss 15% of patients who have HER2-positive disease by immunohistochemistry and would respond to some of these really exciting therapies that we have. And you can see some of these response rates here.
Yes, Jim, this is kind of summarizes some of the data sets we have to work with up to now, using a number of interventions, including, as we were just talking about, zanidatamab and T-DXd, but also trastuzumab and tucatinib, a regimen used in colon cancer. And actually, even before that, from the MyPathway study, trastuzumab and pertuzumab. Anything you want to say, Jim, in terms of globally what we've seen in these trials in terms of impact of anti-HER2 therapy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for the IHC3 plus, certainly the contemporary data from Horizon BTC01 and the Destiny Pan tumor, I think demonstrate if you are IHC3 plus, the response rate exceeds 50%, and those responses are generally durable. If you're IHC2 plus, we do have a bit of an issue in that it's not entirely paralleling the data for HER2-low breast cancer, in that we're not seeing the same level of response. So in Horizon BTC01, and it was 0-5% for zanidatamab in the IHC 2-plus-ish amplified. And then at least in the Destiny pan-tumor, it was 0% for the 2-plus. There was another study called the HERB study where 2-plus did have like a small response rate, somewhere of around 5%. 5-10%. So it's not as potent in that subset, and we need to kind of understand that better and probably have specific studies in that population.
So with that as a background, we'll get more into, of course, the big questions that everybody has, which really revolve around zanidatamab and T-DXd. We'll take a look at the data in a second. But first, I want to divert out into the FGFR world, so to speak, and let you hear a couple cases there. Beginning with a 72-year-old man, a patient of Dr. Kimberly Koo.
He would be in and out of the hospital, whether it was like having a pneumonia or getting COVID or having excess diarrheal illness that we were having a hard time trying to control, even if we tried steroids and hold durvalumab, just a lot of complications. So ultimately, he ended up going into hospice about 8 months into therapy. So my question, especially being in community oncology, where it's not very common to get cholangiocarcinoma as a case, and on top of that, to get FGFR2 fusion. So just wondering what the gestalt would be in starting pemigatinib versus futibatinib versus erdafitinib. I know that we're probably still thinking about, in the clinical trial setting, how do we incorporate these FGFR2 inhibitors in the frontline? And especially in the community, when we think about these patients, we really only probably have the frontline as our opportunity to treat, because in the second line, they often do decline or do feel like they run out of reserve to keep on getting treatment. So very curious to know, what are some of the imminent pipeline studies in the metastatic frontline setting? Very interested in knowing how to manage skin toxicities, if there's any ophthalmologic toxicities. We haven't trained with these drugs, so we're learning them anew, and we're trying to figure out the territory too, like how do we grade the toxicity.
So, Haley, I'm kind of curious, a very common scenario that I heard from all eight of these docs of people who just don't make it to second-line therapy. I'm curious, is that your experience as well? And any thoughts in general, we'll get more into this later, but about bringing up targeted therapy into the first line even before trials are available, or maybe a patient is not, you know, the greatest candidate for chemo. Any thoughts about where that's heading, Haley?
I do think in general, the data would say that patients who move on to second line therapy is smaller than we would like in sort of all comers with biliary tract cancers. Probably academic centers, we're seeing an enriched group of patients who are often trial eligible. So perhaps we see higher numbers of people who are making it to second line therapy. Again, I think this is such an important point to highlight why NGS testing early is so important. Because yes, while these targeted therapies are only approved in the second line setting, when we know patients have an alteration like an FGFR2 rearrangement, I think we're very quick to pivot to those targeted therapies if patients are struggling with toxicity or, you know, progressing very quickly. Targeted therapies can be a great option in terms of clinical efficacy, though certainly the side effect profile of FGFR targeted therapies can be quite a challenge, as Dr. Ku has experienced.
So, we'll get into that in a second. Jim, can you kind of talk a little bit about, in your own words, what actually FGFR fusions are, what happens, and why RNA-based assays are the best to try to pick these up?
Yeah. There are a number of FGFR alterations across cancer, and this pictogram that you have is nice in that it shows overexpression or amplification, i.e., multiple copies of the gene. It also shows point mutations in the FGFR, kinase domain and other portions of the molecule. So that's like a single nucleotide variant. Both of those two things, you know, it's easier to pick that up on next-generation sequencing assays because the assay typically encompasses the entirety of that gene, that is the coding region of that gene or the key coding regions. And so when you have a fusion, it's simply a portion of the signaling molecule of FGFR bound to another upstream, another molecule, usually something that will activate that. And the breakpoint of where they genetically align is not always covered in an NGS assay, and therefore you have to kind of look at RNA and use a different assay. So it is best in fusions to have a reflex RNA panel, which most now do or include it in their panel. It's very important. I think that we probably miss some patients because of that.
I'm curious, Haley, here's a comparison indirectly of the two approved FGFR inhibitors, pemigatinib and futibatinib. Can you talk about, from the point of view of efficacy, how they seem to compare and tolerability? And from your point of view in general, how do you decide which comes first? Can you use one after the other?
Yeah, so in general, I think the clinical efficacy data is fairly similar between pemigatinib and futibatinib across these two studies, FIGHT-202 and PHOENIX-CCA2, you know, with response rates in the range of 35% to 40% and median progression-free survival of around 7 to 9 months. And certainly you can see, you know, this pretty impressive median overall survival approaching 2 years, which again, when we compare that to second-line therapy for biomarker-agnostic patients is about 6 months. This is just really impressive in the second line setting. In terms of how do we sequence these therapies, it sort of remains an unanswered question. We do have data in the preclinical setting about sort of giving futibatinib as essentially a backup therapy. And I think a lot of the sequencing comes down to what is driving resistance to these drugs. So about 60% of resistance to FGFR inhibitors is driven by on-target resistance. So this is mutations in the FGFR2 kinase domain itself. And we can see a different profile of activity of these different FGFR inhibitors to some of these on-target resistance mutations. And for example, futibatinib probably has broader activity against many of these mutations, one of the more common mutations like V565F, which is a really tough to target gatekeeper mutation. So I think that's an area that we're exploring about how do you sequence these therapies to overcome and delay resistance as much as possible and prolong the benefit from FGFR targeted therapy.
And Jim, what about toxicity? Of course, we have a little bit different spectrum that oncologists are used to, including hyperphosphatemia. Can you talk a little bit about how this plays out in practice and How often do patients have significant impact on their quality of life because of these agents, or are you usually able to keep people pretty comfortable?
Yeah. So the hyperphosphatemia, that has to do with, obviously, these drugs don't just target FGFR2, they target FGFR1 and 3, and to some lesser extent, maybe FGFR4. But basically, there's inhibition of FGFR1 in the kidney that leads to sort of a dysregulation of phosphorus excretion, and you can develop hyperphosphatemia. There are set guidelines if you look to the package inserts or guidelines on societies where you might have to educate patients on a low phosphorus diet. You can use phosphate binders to try to control it. I will tolerate an elevated phosphorus of up to 6.5. I watch it closely. Usually it does not have symptoms, and I do find with continued treatment it sort of levels out. But you have to be aware of that. Often if you try to overcorrect it too much, what you'll end up is with hypophosphatemia, which can be symptomatic. So I watch that. A big issue with these drugs, though, is the dermatologic toxicity. You can see alopecia, you can have xerosis, dry skin, dry mouth, mucositis, nail bed toxicity. So, some patients will develop like a subuncal hematoma, and over time, the nail bed becomes quite heaped up, and people will even lose nails, and that's sort of a longer-term toxicity. For the dermatologic component, I work closely with dermatology on this to try to manage symptoms related to it. And then, of course, there can be GI tox, like loose stool, and that may be through FGFR, FGFR3, 4 signaling. So a lot to manage, but if done appropriately with dose reduction, hold, supportive medicines, patients can do well with this medication for a long time.
So as with all of our webinars, we have a lot of great data slides for you to check out in the chat room. We have the whole slide set here. I won't go through all of these, but I did want to ask about, there's some real world data with pemigatinib, again, kind of cementing in what we see in clinical trials. But I want to ask you about this, Haley, FIGHT-302, first line pemigatinib versus chemo. Kind of reminds me of the old osimertinib study. Any thoughts about this trial, Haley? Would you like to make some predictions on what it's going to show? And is this a strategy we would like to do right now before the trial is even done?
Certainly, I think with having strong oncogenic drivers like FGFR2 fusions, rearrangements, and even point mutations, I do think a lot of this data is going to mirror what we see in non-small cell lung cancer, where we can see these, improved response rates and clinical outcomes in the frontline setting. I think what's been really challenging about a lot of these sort of upfront targeted trials has just been trying to run a trial in a rare biomarker in a rare cancer. So the accrual to these studies has been really challenging, and that's why many of them have not been able to accrue. But I am optimistic that particularly with some of the targeted therapy frontline trials we have in other biomarkers, that we'll have increasing data for this like we do in lung cancer.
Jim, if you could, would you use this kind of strategy up front, or maybe a patient who's not too excited about chemotherapy, or do we need to wait for these studies? And I'm just going to click through a bunch of the other data slides we have here for you to check out later, but Jim, what about using first-line FGFR inhibitor? Here's another great one with Dervis's and Jem with pemigatinib, also going to be alternating. Really a fascinating idea. Here's some of the futibatinib data. Jim, what about first-line FGFR before these trials get done?
Well, I do try to follow the evidence, and at least at this point, it has been. Moved into the second line. I also think that we still run into issues with FGFR about getting that test back in a timely fashion. Even though we're moving closer to that, if somebody is very fit and symptomatic, you know, chemoimmunotherapy is effective. And so there's no reason that I wouldn't give it in this fit patient population that's chemoimmunotherapy. I do think it would be great to move it up to earlier stages of the disease. I'm not so sure we're going to have the data in the robust quality that we want. As you know, there were three phase three studies that were launched for FGFR specifically, and two of them ended up closing or due to accrual issues. I mean, it's always a consideration. I always think about it if I know the genotype, and I prefer to try to do this on trials. So
just when you hear one more FGFR case, and then we're going to move on and talk about her too. A young patient, 49 years old, with metastatic recurrent cholangiocarcinoma and FGFR2 rearrangement.
This is a 49-year-old female who basically presented with a large liver mass, as you can see here in this picture. It's a right-sided liver mass, and she had a biopsy showing cholangiocarcinoma. It was FGR mutated as FGFR-MATR3 fusion. At the time of her diagnosis, you know, we thought that all of her disease was in the right side of the liver. She had radioembolization, and she also had portal vein embolization. The hope was we could, you know, treat her specifically to that right side of liver and do a resection. And unfortunately, you know, in the midst of this workup, she then developed lung metastasis, very small here that can be seen in that picture. And so the idea of surgery was abandoned. We moved ahead, continued with systemic therapy. So I initially treated with cisplatin and gemcitabine. There was no immunotherapy at the time she was diagnosed. And then she progressed through cisgem, she progressed through FOLFOX chemotherapy. And actually in 2018, the FGFR2 inhibitors were not approved, but they were being studied and the data looked really good. So we actually opened for her a clinical trial with an FGFR2 inhibitor as a just-in-time clinical trial. And she had tremendous disease control. She really, from 2018 until now, 2025, she's had one solitary liver lesion that came back that we treated with radioembolization. That was just last year. Otherwise, she's continuing on pemigatinib and doing very well. And we did dose reduce her one time because of decreased appetite and weight loss. And with one dose reduction, she's actually continued to tolerate the medication. So
wow.
The question, you know, that I had, you know, this particular patient has an FGFR-MATR3 fusion, and she has had a tremendous duration of benefit ongoing for 7 years with pemigatinib. Is it the particular FGFR fusion that she has as a better susceptibility to benefit from the pemigatinib is the other question. Do you tend to see differences in outcomes based on the FGFR fusions? But I think that this is kind of an amazing case of somebody who got the drug before it was even approved and is still on it to this day, doing well, taking care of her kids. You know, once we dose reduced her, she's tolerating the drug very well.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It is an amazing case.
So, Haley,
fantastic.
Interesting things that you hear. You ever seen a case like that, Haley? Any comments on why?
So I think certainly this is just a phenomenal example that we sometimes do see where people can have these incredibly durable responses to FGFR-targeted therapy. And I think highlighting Dr. Harding's point about, you know, with dose reduction, with good supportive care, patients can tolerate these drugs and have a really good quality of life for a long time. In terms of, you know, what exactly is driving this excellent response, I wouldn't say we totally know the answer to that yet. But, you know, the fusion partner itself has not been shown to make a difference in terms of clinical outcomes. FGFR2 fusions are actually really unique in that there's not one typical binding partner. Certainly things like BIC1 we do see more commonly, but there's been over 140 unique fusion partners described for FGFR2. And really what's driving the oncogenicity of FGFR2 fusions is not the partner, but is actually the loss of the terminal exon of FGFR2. So it's sort of interesting biology and what's driving tumor growth.
All right, so we're going to return back to HER2 targeting. I think we could probably could have used 2 hours for this this program today, but let's see if we can at least get through the HER2. And actually, before we hear this case, Jim, real quick, from the chat room. Hassan wants something we didn't talk about when we were going through HER2 testing, with HER2 mutations. You know, in lung cancer, that's the most common type of HER2 alterations, and they give T-DXd. Do you see HER2 mutations in biliary tract, Jim, and do the zanidatamab and T-DXd, are they effective there?
A great question. Yes, there are single nucleotide variants, point mutations in HER2 that activate HER2 that are observed in biliary tract cancer at a low frequency, a few percent in each subset. There have been attempts to drug those on specific clinical trials, one of which was in neratinib, which had a cholangiocarcinoma basket that showed a response rate of about 16%. T-DXd, unbelievably, for unique biology, has been looked at to treat single nucleotide variants, and it did enroll some biliary tract patients, and there were actually some responders in that cohort. Even trastuzumab and pertuzumab, in the recent TAUPER study, there were some patients that that had just apparent single nucleotide variants. I think one of the issues is the response rates in this population have been lower. The duration of response has been lower. There are still studies targeting this, and it'd be interesting to see more. You know, my impression is that many of these are subclonal. Like, it's not uniform throughout. In our data set at Memorial, we've genotype now almost 3,000 of biliary tract cancer patients, and particularly in gallbladder, HER2 is these missense mutations are subclonal. So I don't know if it's a dominant driver, and thus I speculate that it might not have as much activity. But I'm interested to see, you know, some of the upcoming studies that are still looking at this.
So we saved the best for last. So the most common question I heard from these docs, which is sort of what comes first and how do you think this thing through? Here's Dr. Morgenstein with a 63-year-old woman, HER2-positive cholangiocarcinoma, who develops metastatic disease on adjuvant treatment.
This is a 63-year-old female. She was just diagnosed with stage 3B gallbladder cancer. Very sweet woman. Received adjuvant capecitabine with really no particular issues. And then right at the end of her 6 months of treatment, she started to develop some abdominal pain and was diagnosed with metastatic cancer in her liver only. She's currently on cisplatinum, gemcitabine, and durvalumab, which she's tolerating well. Her NGS was positive for HER2 3+. No other targetable mutations were found. So the question is, do we ever use HER2-based therapy as a first-line treatment? And then on this patient who almost certainly will progress on her first-line therapy, what's the next best option now that we have two of them, which is kind of crazy, T-DXd or zanidatamab? And is there any role or knowledge about sequencing?
So, Haley, let's take a look at some of the data with these two options. Of course, we saw last fall the approval of zanidatamab, a bispecific targeting two epitopes on the HER2 molecule. I don't know whether you view this way or not, Haley, but targeting kind of the same thing that trastuzumab and pertuzumab does. We'll get into that in a second. But we saw last year at ASCO the Horizon BTC01 study. Can you talk a little bit about your vision, Haley, about how this agent actually works?
So I think zanidatamab has a really unique mechanism of action. Exactly as you said, it's targeting two different epitopes on HER2 itself, but sort of the downstream activity of this drug is really unique because we see sort of increased cross-linking of HER2 on the surface. We also then see ultimately lots more sort of immune-mediated mechanisms downstream of that, as well as increased internalization of HER2. So I think that's probably what's driving some of the increased clinical activity that we're seeing with this molecule compared to trastuzumab, pertuzumab, which has been studied in biliary tract cancer as well.
And Jim, here are some of the efficacy data in terms of a PFS, but particularly the waterfall plot. I mean, I hear in a lot of cases of people with objective responses. In a way, when I think about the mechanism targeting these two epitopes, it's really interesting that you actually see these kinds of objective responses. Jim, can you talk about not only the data from the trial, but your own clinical experience with zanidatamab in terms of efficacy?
Sure. This is, I think, a great example of an active precision medicine. And obviously, Horizon BTC 01 demonstrated an objective response rate of 40% in a HER2 amplified 3+ and 2+. That was an 80-patient cohort. And as you can see from the waterfall plot, you know, the majority of patients have some degree of tumor shrinkage. There are a number with a complete response. Based on the color coding, you can see that it occurred in all anatomic subsets. By the asterisk, you can see potentially there might be differential response based on the HER2 IHC. For 3+, it was about 50%. For 2+, 5%. The median duration of response for the entire cohort was, at long-term follow-up, almost 15 months. So this is quite durable. And it's just paralleled my clinical experience. I mean, I have patients that I've had on zanidatamab for years that have responded exceedingly well. That's a proportion of patients. And in general, it is a tolerable drug. It's administered every 2 weeks. Main toxicities would be potentially diarrhea, which is, I think, to the oncologist, you know, well managed, well understood that that's a potential reaction. One thing not as commonly seen with HER2 target therapies is infusion-related reaction. Most of these are low-grade. We do pre-medicate to prevent it. And if this occurs, usually can be overcome with, you know, re-challenge at just half the dosing rate, and people can continue on it. So overall, I found it to be a tolerable and active regimen, and I, you know, look to see how the confirmatory study, the Horizon BTC 302, will read out.
So, Haley, curious for your thoughts. You presented a case at a recent CME program we did of a 45-year-old lady who had a 10-month partial response. I'm curious what happened to that lady in terms of quality of life, what kind of toxicity she has had, and what you've seen in general in terms of efficacy and tolerability of this agent.
So I completely echo Dr. Harding's comments. Again, I think the real world experiences that we've had certainly mirror the data that's been presented in the Horizon study, in that, you know, people that respond are having truly durable responses. And the patient who I had presented, you know, continues to stay on drug with really an excellent quality of life, had some very mild diarrhea, which was very manageable. But in general, I think this is a really well-tolerated option, particularly after people are coming off of first-line chemotherapy.
So, Jim, any comments on this paper from ASCO looking at survival outcomes, I guess indirectly comparing to patients who get chemotherapy with zanidatamab? And also the experience with and now an ongoing clinical trial that you're running looking at zanidatamab in the first-line setting. Again, here's some data on first-line zani with cisgem that was presented at the ESMO GI meeting. But in particular, I'm curious about your thoughts concerning the actual trial that you're doing, looking at, this is the Horizon BTC 302 phase 3 study, looking at this with standard of care therapy.
Yeah, so I think the study is really a critical that we, you know, promote and enroll in a global fashion. I mean, as we talked about earlier, Dr. Ellis mentioned, I don't know if it was in the context of this or we were speaking of it earlier, you know, in some subsets of biliary tract cancer, HER2 is quite common, 30% of gallbladder cancers, and we can test for it based on immunohistochemistry, which we've been doing for a long time. So we can identify patients quickly with with HER2 amplification and overexpression in biliary tract cancer. And this study is basically looking at a treatment-naive patient population, centrally testing for HER2 positivity, either IHC3+ or 2+ with ISH positivity, and then randomizing patients to receive a standard of care GemCis immunotherapy or GemCis immunotherapy zanidatamab. It is an open label study. Primary endpoint is actually PFS, to understand that there will be unintentional crossover to HER2 targeted therapies in the second line. The study is enrolling globally, and I hope that we're successful in at least enrolling the study to answer the question. It's, I think, very important to confirm the phase 2 data and potentially to move this to an earlier stage of disease, where with potentially hitting multiple pathways, chemo, immuno, HER2, we might see a nice outcome, but we have to prove it.
And of course, I'm not going to go through all the data because we've gone through this so many times with the TDXD and multiple cancers, and including biliary, where actually the number of patients is less than with the zanidatamab study because it's part of a basket study, but still seeing effective response rates. Haley, of course, the number one question all the oncologists are asking is, what comes first and can I use one after the other? How do you think through which anti-HER strategy to go with first, Haley?
So, of course, I would say, you know, we individualize and personalize these treatment discussions to our patients and how they're doing in general. But I think, you know, all things being equal, the clinical efficacy and safety profile of zanidatamab is a very attractive option coming off of, you know, oftentimes many months of first-line gemcitabine, cisplatin, and immunotherapy. Has very non-chemo-like side effects in many ways and very low-grade manageable side effects. So I think it's a great option with great data. And I think the mechanism of TDXD in terms of things like the bystander effect, and even the TDXD study, DESTINY-PanTumor, had 17% of patients that had prior HER2 therapy and still showed some response. So I do think there's some, again, very small amounts of data to suggest that TDXD potentially has activity even in the HER2 refractory setting.
And here are the two big first-line trials. Interesting kind of different strategy here. You have, as we mentioned before, the HERIZON study of Zani plus standard therapy. But then with TDXD, they're actually comparing Gem Platinum with Durva versus TDXD alone. We mentioned this bispecific with rivlogostimab. So it'll be really interesting. Jim, what is your perspective on sort of what comes first? And have you seen responses to the second HER2 strategy after the first one?
Yeah, I agree. It's a shared decision-making experience with patients. I do tend to, given the favorable toxicity profile, I do tend to discuss zanidatamab, and that has been often what I have been using in this space. And I have observed TDXD, and we've seen that in other GI tumors, to have activity after failure of a HER2 targeted therapy. So I think that sequence is reasonable. I think having both of the studies enroll and accrue will answer a lot of questions for the field. I think it's good that there are two because it allows us to have more options, and I think both of which are quite reasonable.
So final question back to you, Haley. Again, I like to ask people in different, you know, now TDXD is used by all different tumor types, so we have different sets of investigators. I'm curious what your experience has been with acute GI toxicity. I think as time has gone on, people have gotten more and more sensitive to that with TDXD, with the chemo payload, and how you compare quality of life on TDXD, at least initially, for example, to zanidatamab.
So I do think TDXD in many ways, because of that chemo payload, is very chemo-like in terms of its side effects, both in terms of GI toxicity, cytopenias, fatigue. I think we've gotten better over the years at sort of aggressively pre-medicating people with antiemetics. And also carefully monitoring for toxicities like interstitial lung disease is also really critical. But I do think, again, sometimes it is challenging for patients after they've had a lot of chemotherapy prior to T-DXd to continue with more T-DXd. But it is a highly effective therapy. And again, it's great to have multiple options. And I hope we'll have more data about how best to sequence these as we move forward.
So really amazing to think that in an hour, we can't even get through biliary cancer nowadays. There's so much to talk about. But I want to thank you, Haley, and you, Jim, for enlightening us today. Audience, thank you for coming. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Haley. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.